Lecture 14, Hobbes and Locke. In our review of the history of natural law thinking, we have noticed that this moral theory has taken some very diverse forms in the course of the years. The period of the 16th to 18th century is no exception, and in fact is a very strong example of how different this theory of natural law can look. The early modern period in Europe is a period in which there emerged a very strong streak of liberal individualism. We see this in figures like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, who will be the centerpieces for this particular lecture, as we focus on what natural law theory meant given that liberal individualism. For Thomas Hobbes, it was, I think, a matter of a very radical individualism, that it leads him to assume a state of nature in which there was no government, no social organization, but only a very strong drive for self-preservation. And that very strong drive places one in competition with others who are also operating under a strong drive, such that the state of nature is a state of war, a war of all against all. Natural law, in the theory of Hobbes, then, is rather a practical set of rules for survival. By contrast, John Locke, figure who is so important for the history of political thinking in our own country, follows out the thinking of people like the Anglican Richard Hooker and Samuel Pufendorf, and he offers a theory of natural law that gives natural law yet another different cast, namely natural law as natural rights theory. Locke assumes a very strong form of the natural equality that prevailed in the original state of nature, but he envisions it not as a state of the war of all against all, so much as a condition of real peace and goodwill, so much so that people were willing to establish a social contract. And in the course of establishing that social contract, they're willing to give up some of their natural rights, for example, the right to punish those who transgress the natural law, transgress our right to be left in peace, in order to get a more secure protection for our other natural rights. This lecture, then, will be a lecture on natural law in the early modern period, and what I'd like to do first is to review some of the characteristics that are typical of natural law thinking throughout this period, then to turn to discuss Thomas Hobbes in some detail, and to conclude with a more detailed view of John Locke, and we'll have a fine sense, I think, of natural law in this historical period. By way of overview, it seems to me that there are three strong characteristics of natural law in this period, and they grow out of that late medieval nominalism and the reactions to the Thomistic synthesis. First, this natural law in the modern period is very rationalistic. I use that word in the sense in which it tends to be used within the history of philosophy, namely that claims about knowing the truth are restricted to things that are entirely and completely within the realm of human achievement. We human beings have to figure it out. We have to divide and analyze and resynthesize. Things are true when we can break them down and understand why they work. Things are true when we put them together. On the other hand, this is very definitely anti-supernaturalist. That is, there's a great suspicion about claims to supernatural truth. I personally suspect that this stems from the wars of religion, in which there were strong claims being made in the name of religion, Catholic and Protestant, such that there were wars over those subjects. And the grave suspicion that came about to whether there could be any truth about supernatural, whether one could know the truth in matters of religion or in matters of transcendence. And this suspicion that one can't know the truth about God or about the church or about matters of religion tended to work over into the area of morality. And it's something I think that still very much is a part of many modern mindsets, namely that one can't know the truth about morals, whereas we have seen in all the lectures up until this time that those ages were very much inclined to think that one could know the truth about morality. Granted that there were differences of opinion about what that truth was, but I didn't sense that there was much of a skepticism about the possibility of knowing truth in principle. Rather, there were simply problems in practice. This age is very deeply rationalistic, in which claims of faith, claims of revelation, claims of religion are privatized, are things that people may hold, individuals may want to believe, but about which one cannot have any strong truth claim made. Second basic characteristic of this period is that it is deeply individualist. I have been trying to emphasize throughout the lectures so far that Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, and the various canon lawyers all understood society to be natural. They understood human beings to have a deep sociality in their nature. They stressed the dependence relations, and they had a strong sense that we invariably find ourselves in context of family, in context of states and nations, and that this is natural, not that there is any one specific way in which families are organized or political communities are organized, but that it's natural because we naturally need it. We cannot get along without it, that we are social by nature because of our natural neediness. This age, I think we'll see as we start to review Hobbes and Locke, tends to be very deeply individualist. That is, society is envisioned as a matter of human agreement rather than something that has a nature to it or is in any way natural. And we'll see social contract theory having a tremendous place of importance. It is not the case for these thinkers that society is an entity with its own nature. Hence, there will be increasing appeals to the consent of the governed for any forms of political legitimacy, as well as for moral consensus. Thirdly, it is an age which was politically radical, in the sense that there were tremendous transformations in the way in which human society would be governed and human society would be organized. One sees this, for instance, in the overturning of aristocracies. One sees this in the rise of bourgeois society. One sees this in the rise of the democracies. But natural law plays a part in all of this as an ideology, a revolutionary ideology, which will serve as a justification for these vast changes in economic, political, and social relationships. Let's turn to the two figures in question. They both are making a radical break, but making it in very different ways. First, the earlier figure is Thomas Hobbes, whose famous book is The Leviathan in the year 1651. And with Hobbes, we see a radically individualist form of natural law. Consider first Hobbes's basic assumptions. He assumes that there is a state of nature. I suspect that he gets the idea probably from Christian reflection upon the Garden of Eden. If anything was a state of nature, it was that, which people were pure and innocent. But Hobbes's state of nature is different from that. It's a state in which not only is there no government, no organization of society at all, but life is ultimately individualist, and life is, in the famous phrase that is always associated with Hobbes, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. What we find, then, in Hobbes' state of nature is a whole set of human individuals who are dominated by an inner drive for self-preservation. And this drive to live a little longer, to find a way to make life better, given the conflicts and given the enormous pressure of dealing with other individuals who are similarly motivated, puts any individual person necessarily into conflict with others because all are operating under the same drive. The only viable solution, according to Hobbes, for a person in such a predicament, is that one should seek peace by a social contract. So the problem is we're in a state of war and we can't do anything about it. We want an end to the state of war, and the way to do this is to form a society. But how should we make such a society? The society is not a natural thing at all. It's not an entity which has a nature. It's rather something that we have to give a nature to, that we have to decide upon on the basis of a calculation of our own self-interest and a willingness, perhaps, to surrender some of our natural freedom of movement, some of our natural liberty, to a sovereign if that sovereign can guarantee us some of the peace, some of the protection of our own existence that we so desperately desire. When we choose to do this, says Hobbes in The Leviathan, we will submit to a sovereign and we'll expect that this submission will be complete, that the sovereign whom we decide upon when we organize a society will now have absolute authority in everything, except with respect to preserving the life of the citizens. That is, there will be no arbitrary right on the part of the sovereign to exact the lives of the citizens. That was the very reason for entering into the social contract, and that drive of self-preservation governs even this. But in every other respect, in our economic relations, in our political relations, in what we may do and what we may not do, we may have to yield some of our freedoms to the sovereign. This, for Hobbes, is a very vast curtailing of the natural right of freedom, because it is the thing which is so basic in the state of nature. Namely, one may do absolutely anything precisely in order to preserve one's life. And if that absolutely anything means giving away virtually everything, one may be tempted to do that. If one can get away with less, so much the better. But there's no intrinsic restriction on what the sovereign may ask of us. This, in a way, is a justification of absolute power. It is perhaps a borrowing of Machiavellian politics. What does natural law mean for Hobbes? He does use the term, for example, in the 15th chapter of The Leviathan. And yet when he speaks of natural law in that 15th chapter, the laws of nature that he envisioned are, I think, not laws in the strict sense at all. For Hobbes cannot envision law as binding unless it is backed by sufficient force. Power is the name of the game. And it is only in society where there are sovereigns, where there are authorities that have been created by human construct, that there will be a sufficient power of the enforcement of rules by the sovereign. Morality is nothing natural. All of morality is likewise constructed, a matter of human invention, and at best what it is a set of practical rules that an individual may devise for the sake of surviving and protecting what of natural liberty he is able to protect, given the kind of deal that he can make, given the fashion, the function, and the particular form of the social contract that he enters to try to gain greater security for his life and perhaps to end the war of all against all. Hence, for Hobbes, natural law reduces to just one law, not in the sense that Aquinas had reduced natural law to that single principle of doing the good and avoiding the evil, and then multiplied natural law at the secondary level, depending on the set of natural inclinations we were considering for the sake of the specification of the principle. Rather, for Hobbes, natural law is a single law, namely, at all costs, do what you need to do to preserve yourself. Here, prudent reasoning, that is, reason considered not so much trying to understand the nature of the human being or the nature of family or the nature of government, but rather reason envisioned purely as instrumental, reason as calculating the means necessary to get to our end. Practical reasoning in this sense may well involve deciding to achieve one's self-preservation by being very respectful of the social order we devise, being very humble in that respect. It will allow others to protect themselves as well, and even if it means some vast curtailing of my liberty to do lots of other things, I will do that if it will allow the sovereign to maintain the social order in which my existence is more secure. In effect, then, for Hobbes, natural law has but a single principle and is extremely pragmatic. It does not involve reflection on the nature of things, but rather involves the calculative use of reason to try to preserve my existence. And if that preservation of my existence brings me to choose certain things for the good of the community, it will do so because the community's good coincides with my own long-term interests. This has to carry weight over any impulse to seek a short-term interest. And morality is simply going to be cleverness and prudence and success in observing this one single principle. The sense in which Thomas Hobbes's theory is still natural law is that he presents moral principles as derived from what he regards as the most important facet of human nature. You could say this is just power politics, but he's still thinking and still using the term natural law because, I think, of the venerable tradition and reputation that this term has. Where traditional natural law, in any of the forms that we've examined, always assumed just a tremendous vast order to the universe, hierarchically arranged, Hobbes is strong that human artifice alone is what produces order out of the chaos and out of the war, and given the fact that there will inevitably be conflict, this is the best that we can do. Hobbes replaces what had been a hierarchy of goods, the sort of thing that Augustine had so emphasized and that Aquinas repeated. He replaces that hierarchy of goods with a single basic good, namely self-preservation. Anything else that we can get on top of that is certainly frosting on the cake. Natural law theory had a very different view of human reason. I need to stress this a little bit because of the vast difference we have here, and merely to say the word reason can easily give the wrong idea. In the classical sense, reason that they were referring to, the reason is deeply receptive to goods that are already built into the system. Natural law used the term reason in its ancient and medieval versions always to refer to our participation in what is ultimately something divine. It's, in a way, the most godlike part of us. But it's our ability to understand that natural teleology, our ability to understand the essences of things, the natural kinds that there are, and the way in which those natures have an inbuilt end and even an inclination to that end. Our reason is not what is creating or altering or controlling the system. Our reason is primarily receptive to start with. It then turns practical, devising ways to foster those ends, devising ways to make sure that the frustrations do not occur. But it is first receptive and then practical and creative. This vision of reason is vastly different than that. It's very much instrumental, given the fact that we have a strong impulse. And we'll see that in that readiness to trust impulse and that instrumentalization of reason continuing with figures like Rousseau or Nietzsche, where there's a strong sense that our impulses really govern us. Now, the vision that I'm giving is a very radical vision, and needless to say, Hobbes' ideas provoked an enormous and vigorous reaction by people who perhaps hadn't thought about it in a while, but could clearly see that they needed to say that people are more reasonable than that, and that reason isn't just instrumental, that reason has an ability to discern natural goods and natural ends, that there's somehow got to be more to morality than that. One finds, for instance, in a figure like Samuel Pufendorf, in his 1672 book, De Jure Naturae Agentium, notice how he's putting together some of those medieval themes, on the law of nature and of the nations. He argues for the existence of various natural inclinations, a natural inclination toward sociability, as well as a natural inclination to self-love. That's a very strong reaction to Hobbes. Even more so, though, I'd like to concentrate in the minutes that remain for this lecture upon John Locke, who uses Pufendorf and also uses others in the Anglican tradition, such as Richard Hooker, to devise a natural law theory that is much more friendly to nature ideas, much more balanced in its focus upon natural rights, and tries to derive an objective, universal, and intellectually accessible theory of natural law in a way that counters that which is offered by Thomas Hobbes. Locke's famous book on the subject is Second Treatise of Civil Government in 1691. That date, I think, is particularly significant. It is just 3 years after the glorious revolution in England that brought William of Orange to the throne. And what was so inspiring about the glorious revolution to English eyes was that it was a bloodless revolution. It seemed to be a great triumph of reason, instituting a new form of order that was very reasonable and respected as nearly as it could the interests of the mercantile class, the interests of interests of an economic sort, but one which focused upon the English individual and tried to preserve his rights. John Locke's theory in 1691 is, I think, an effort to justify that particular revolution that was so bloodless in 1688. I mention this because Locke had earlier on, back in the year 1664, published a work, written a work, which he never published, in Latin, and it was a book called Essays on the Law of Nature that had a much more traditional view. It was a view much more like Aquinas. It was a view that was very, very close to Hooker, who is an Anglican divine who is very indebted to Aquinas. But in 1691, he adopts an entirely different stance, retaining the name natural law, and this is part of natural law's very diversified history, and retaining some some aspects of traditional natural law, but now using the notion of social contract. If Aquinas baptized Aristotle, perhaps we could say that what Locke does is to baptize, or at least to transform, Hobbes and the notion of a state of nature and a social contract. Following a suggestion about the need to consider pre-political society in the way that Hooker suggests, Locke urges that pre-political society, that state of nature that Thomas Hobbes had talked about, or the Garden of Eden that the Book of Genesis suggests, requires that there be some consent by the inhabitants to any form of society that would emerge. Locke articulates this using the language of social contract. He envisions a state of nature, but it's not a state of nature like Thomas Hobbes, in which there was a war of all against all. Rather, the state of nature for Locke is a state of peace, goodwill, mutual assistance, and preservation. There's a sense here of a fundamental natural equality of all the individuals, and that what these individuals in the state of nature do is that they consent to a form of society which later on will involve consent to a certain form of government. So he's making it a two-stage process. Namely, first of all, we decide on a social contract about how we're going to organize ourselves, and then within that social contract, we will subsequently consent to some particular form of government. He also envisions the problem of successive generations. That is, that's all fine. Individuals can give their consent in the state of nature with respect to what form society will take and what form government will have. But how about those in successive generations? There he urges that as long as we don't protest, we're still giving our tacit consent. It's not a brand new idea. In fact, Socrates had used it. When Socrates was on trial so many hundreds of years before, he discourses with his friends who are urging him to flee the city, and they're willing to provide him a way to escape. But Socrates himself had insisted, I never gave any particular approval to this government, but since I've accepted its largesse over so many years, since I accepted its education and protection, I have tacitly consented to this. So Locke stands in the tradition of Socrates in making that particular suggestion. Now, for Locke, even though the purpose of government is to render our freedom more secure, what each individual has to give up in entering into the social contract is a portion of natural freedom. Namely, when someone else comes and acts against us in a way somehow to deprive us of hard work that we've done that has resulted in property or perhaps has injured or risked our life, any transgression of our natural rights is something that we ourselves ought to punish. If someone's done me a wrong, I ought to see to it. But given that some individuals are weak and they will be taken advantage of easily, especially by a stronger person or by an armed band, it is precisely this sense of our right to punish the individual which we will have to give over if we intend to have more secure possession of the rest of our rights. Hence, Locke's idea is that we form governments precisely in order to give them the power to punish. Again, there's a lot of good sense here, I think. We are very, very poor judges in our own case, and so it's always been helpful in anyone's theory of justice to have a neutral, impartial administrator of justice who can decide upon the merits of a case, who can try innocence and guilt, and then enforce the decision that has been made. For Locke, this need to resort to an impartial authority precisely in order to have more secure possession of the rights that are so much in danger is the very reason why we would enter into the social contract, and the first of our rights which we give over to government. But thereafter, the government should be very minimal in terms of how much else it asks us to give up. And Locke is the source of the line that Jefferson will use eventually in the Declaration of Independence, namely that we have, by our nature, the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and, for Locke, property. Jefferson will modify that in a later draft of the Declaration to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For Locke, however, thinking, I think, of the Glorious Revolution in England in 1688 and the tremendous importance of property, a propertied class, and the ability of the individual to have full and complete or as complete rights as possible over property, Locke envisions there to be a natural right of property. Now, I had stressed a few lectures ago that when the canonists, Gratian in particular, were trying to articulate what the natural law required, one of the interesting theses that they understand and that they profess and that they reflect upon as the philosophers take over in the 12th and 13th centuries is the notion that all physical goods are primarily common and only secondarily private. Now, Locke has a version of that too, namely that all the goods in the state of nature are there for anybody's possible use. His claim is not that we have a natural right to this property or to that property, but rather we have a natural right to acquire property. And one finds in Locke a very interesting and sophisticated theory about how private property emerges. It's a theory that will, of course, be influential not only in the justification of the liberal regimes, such as we're finding here, the justification of the results of the Glorious Revolution, but it's something, of course, that will be enormously influential when we find later on Karl Marx sitting in the library of the British Museum and reading John Locke for his own theory of property. What Locke's theory of property is this, namely that with all of that set of physical goods that are available to us in the world, something becomes our own. Property emerges when we put our labor into it. For example, if we have taken and plowed a field, that field will now be able to generate enormously more grain and feed many more people than the grain that is harvested from growing in the wild. That by nature, the field would yield only what is gathered, what is happenstance to be produced. Whereas if we till the field, we can make that field much more productive, but that we are entitled to the results of our labor, and hence we may claim that grain as our own. This, for Locke, is the ultimate basis of any particular property we have. He claims that it's a natural right because it's our labor, and hence, as a matter of natural justice, we are entitled to whatever it is that is our own. It's a matter of mixing our labor with any of the goods that were initially common that now makes them specially ours. Is there any limit to this? Locke asks the question at various points in his second treatise on government, and he finds that there's only one intrinsic limit to the right of property, and that's spoilage. So that if we're thinking, for instance, in an agrarian society about the fruits that we might gather from our trees or about the livestock that we might have on our land and that we might come to butcher, about the grain that might grow in our fields, his claim is that one is entitled to as much property as one can, in fact, produce by the introduction of one's labor into these physical goods, but one may not be wasteful. So that if the grain would spoil, if the fruit would spoil, or the meat, there's a limit to what it is that we may properly take from this common stock. Of course, the answer to that problem is money and the invention of a currency, the invention of a means of exchange, so that if we should grow or manage to produce by our livestock more than we can use, nonetheless we can get the value of our labor so long as we can transform the livestock or that set of fruit or grain into a form like money, which can be exchanged with others who are in need of such. Now, this, of course, is a justification for the enormous increase in wealth that was just at that stage in England beginning to be the case by virtue of the new royal and economic arrangements. And so there's a way in which I think Locke can also be seen to be trying to justify a particular economic arrangement. This stands in some contrast to the notion in the Middle Ages, and it's a part of what it is that the modern economic system is when it comes under the perspective of natural law, that we need to be considering natural laws and justice even about these newly devised means of exchange. Back in the Middle Ages, there had been a worry about, for instance, charging any money at usury, any money at interest, precisely because of those biblical injunctions, but also for natural law reasons, namely a sense that money by itself doesn't produce anything. Money by itself should be purely a means of exchange, whereas in modern capitalist systems, even having money on loan or money invested in the market, money invested in the various forms that have now been devised, money can generate new money. And Locke's system is the beginning of the natural law justification of what in the Middle Ages, I think, had been something that was regarded with suspicion. as if the charge of any interest at all was usury, where in modern forums, I think we're accustomed to say that usury is a matter of excessive interest. Finally, one last point on Locke. Locke is very alert to that glorious revolution in England, and he's pondering philosophically the problem of revolution. That is, may one set aside a form of government that had been previously chosen, that had been previously consented to by an earlier generation? He argues that there is such a thing as a right to revolution. When? If one's natural rights are seriously violated, and if no other way to adjudicate the problem remains. I think we can easily see how influential this will be for the American colonists in the justification used in the Declaration of Independence, and we'll consider that in a coming lecture.